From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, how those who lived through Spain's dictatorship are still struggling for justice, over 40 years after the death of Franco. This past week, the Spanish Supreme Court ruled that the government could go ahead and exhume the body of former dictator Francisco Franco from the mausoleum and basilica he had built outside Madrid, known as the Valley of the Fallen. Beneath the basilica is a mass grave holding the remains of some 33,000 Civil War victims and others.
This was a unanimous ruling by the Supreme Court judges, six judges. The Francisco Franco Foundation, however, says that it will appeal, that it will go to the Constitutional Court.
The Spanish Civil War lasted from 1936 to 1939. The victor, fascist General Franco, received aid from both Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. Franco ruled Spain until his natural death in 1975. Spain's transition to democracy came with a general amnesty and an agreement on all sides to simply forget and move forward, an idea that became known as the Pact of Forgetting. Over the last 20 years, there's been a rising call from the left to bring more attention to those who suffered and died under the dictatorship and to the Civil War itself. When the Socialist Party took power in Spain, it began a push to remove Franco's remains and turn the Valley of the Fallen into a place of history and memory.
Can you picture a monument 20 kilometers away from Berlin in honor of Hitler, or one 20 kilometers away from Rome in honor of Mussolini? I don't want that for my country, because I want to have a country that is democratically advanced. I'd want to put an end to that abnormality, and so does the Prime Minister and Spanish society.
Caught in the middle of all this are those still seeking justice from harms done under Franco. Their story is told in the award-winning documentary, The Silence of Others, which was co-directed by Almudena Caracedo and Robert Bahar. It debuts on PBS on Monday, September 30th. Almudena Caracedo is our guest today. So let's start with something really basic, and I'm sure you've been asked this 100 times, but how did you decide to look at this subject?
It's an important question because it's something that's not normally discussed. And obviously, the obvious reason is that I'm Spanish, right? My parents were part of the struggle against the dictatorship in a very low key, but I do remember them running from the police, for example. And I think that image for me was very powerful as I was coming to understanding a little bit more about this, because obviously this is a knowledge that was not transmitted to our generation. We knew a little bit of everything or a little bit of some things, but we didn't understand the context of impunity and in general what had happened. And so I think the actual moment when me and my co-director and also life partner Robert decided to get into this was actually a sort of a powerful moment when we had just had our daughter. This was 2010, and the news about the stolen children started coming out of Spain. And I do remember having the baby in my arms and reading these stories, like, you know, drenched in tears, and saying, this is going to be our next film.
Tell us what the stolen children scandal was and what happened and what it felt like to be a newborn mother reading it.
Right. So there had always been rumors about this idea that children were stolen in Spain. For the most part, people always thought that mothers were crazy, you know, like the postpartum or the afterbirth moment is a very delicate moment. And so a lot of women had been told that their children had died, and they always were thought to be crazy, you know. What happened is that in 2010, even a little bit earlier, there started being some investigations on the stolen children cases where it was clear that there had been like thousands and thousands of babies stolen under the same sort of like network. It all started after the Spanish Civil War in 1939. The Franco troops would actually take children away from those mothers in prison, political opponents, and give them to families loyal to the regime. And this practice evolved over time, and we're talking about cases up to the 90s. So this practice evolved into a criminal enterprise, so as to say that had sort of an economic motivation, but at the same time, it had like a moral component. It was always done to single mothers, mothers with too many children, etc. And, you know, I started reading those news, and I understood that this could be sort of a powerful angle to look at the legacy of the Franco regime in present day Spain.
So let's back up to what year were you born?
I was born in 72. So I was three when Franco died. I lived sort of as a very, very young child, sort of the transition years from dictatorship to democracy. But I was part of the generation that already when I arrived to school, nothing was said. So I didn't ever study anything about this.
So what did you know about the Spanish Civil War growing up? What did you hear about it?
Well, what we are used to knowing or learning as Spaniards growing up in Spain, right, is sort of the equidistant sort of theory. Like there were two sides. There were crimes committed on both sides, brother against brother. Therefore, we must forget it. We need to leave this in the past so that we can move forward, right? What we weren't told is obviously the specifics of first how the war started. It was a coup d'etat to start with. Obviously, the specifics of how the war developed, sort of the support of Hitler and Mussolini to one side, and basically the blockage of all the other democratic countries to the emergent republic that had been elected. So all of this is kind of something that we barely study. The joke that people say here is that the Spanish Civil War comes at the end of the history book. And so it's very convenient because if some teachers don't want to teach it, it's a very wonderful excuse that you didn't make it to the end of the book, you know. And so essentially, my generation is discovering all these things. And so, for example, when we screen the film to younger generations, they are absolutely indignant because they know absolutely nothing of what we are saying in the film.
Before we go on, let me ask you one question. Just tell me which city you grew up in.
I grew up in Madrid.
And where were your grandparents during the war?
They're all from Extremadura, the south of Spain.
And did they ever speak to you about their experiences during the war?
No, families don't speak too much here. So when you have extended families, you have learned not to say too much. And again, I think this has changed. Like now I think I can speak to my cousins, especially after the film came out. We started talking a lot more about that. But in general, when you had a family meeting with extended family, this is one of the things that you do not discuss because you don't want to start getting into fights with people who think one way or the other. So silences are also within families. The people in my generation has at least a direct connection to the transition moment, right? Because we lifted, although we were very little. I did know little pieces here and there. Obviously, I knew who Franco was. And so I feel I did have, in Spanish, you have a word which is inquietud. I did have that within me to try to understand how could we have come to this moment of impunity where in 2019, all these crimes are still there. There's, you know, 114,000 people disappeared in mass graves. So I did know enough that I wanted to question and know more. But the truth is that we didn't understand, you know, the extent of the repression, the extent of the impunity in Spain right now.
And one thing I should establish is that you keep referring to the transition, and what you mean is the transition to democracy.
Correct.
And in those early years after Franco's death in 1975, Spain has two things that become both central to your film and central to Spain's transition, which is one is called the Pact of Forgetting in English, and the other is the amnesty law. Can you explain both of those things to us?
Right. So basically, Franco died in 1975. He died in bed. Therefore, he died in power. So the question was how to transition the country from that dictatorship that had been almost 40 years long to a democracy. In 1977, Parliament voted the amnesty law, which was intended. It was a response to an incredible social movement in the streets to free political prisoners that had been imprisoned because of their fight against a dictatorship. So you would call freedom fighters or something like that, right? So by 1977, a lot of those people had already been freed, but there is a law. And in the last minute, there's a second article added to the law that exonerates from responsibility anyone from the regime that had committed political crimes in nature, right? And so What came with the amnesty law was this idea of the pact of forgetting, or some people call it pact of silence, right? This sort of non-written law that in order to move forward, we had to forget. It was sort of like a decree to impose forgetting. And there is a politician in the film saying exactly these words. It's an amnesty for all. It's a forgetting for all. It's the only way that we can actually shake hands, you know. And he also says something really powerful, but it's very important that we bring this down into the whole society, because it was considered completely impolite to start sort of like rocking the boat with your stories on how you were tortured, for example. All of this has changed really in the last years, that we must leave everything behind as though you can actually impose forgetting on people, you know.
The issue of silence is, of course, wraps around the entire film, including your title. It's more of a silence than a forgetting, right? Because it's divisions within villages and within families. What were people silent about, both the war and the aftermath and then the transition? Talk to me about what silence does.
Silence erases collective memory. It does not erase individual memory. And for many years, memory was confined to the homes or even to the people themselves. Silence was due to fear, to protection. If someone had killed your grandfather, very likely you didn't even know, because they were trying to protect you. And so for many, many years, silence was the way for families to protect their children from experiencing the same amount of terror and repression that their families had endured and lived in the past, right? And what it does is exactly this idea that something that should be public, the memory of a war, the memory of extrajudicial killings, actually becomes something confined to the private. And that's probably the most powerful effect of silence in a society.
Tell me about your decision to focus on characters that were affected not just by the Civil War, but also by the years of dictatorship and the aftermath.
Right. You know, there was a huge sense of responsibility too, right? How do we do this right? How do we do justice to not just what happened, but what's happening? And so it was very important for us that the film was told in present. There's this whole thing in Spain, oh, that story belongs to our grandparents. You know, we're not there anymore. We're in the present. We want it for people to understand that this is something present, you know, that the struggle is present, the suffering is present. And so the idea was to be able to capture sort of the experience of this journey towards justice and to be able to live along our characters that journey towards justice, right? And so we found people that had experienced repression immediately after the Civil War, but also all the way to young people, people who were young in the transition to democracy and who were tortured in 1974, 75, 76, etc., who are alive and whose tortures are still alive and walking free in the street. And for us, this was the way to create this mosaic. It's not something of the past. It's definitely something of the present.
So I'm going to turn now to your characters, and I want to start with Maria Martin, who begins the film and is this very effective voice for the impact of the war itself. Can you tell me a bit about her story?
Right. Maria Martin is an old lady in the film who at age 6, she had to witness how her mother was taken away from her. She was her head was shaved. She was walked in town and then later executed. And she ended up being buried by the side of the road, like hundreds of thousands of people at that time. She was a civilian. She had not participated in the war. And in this particular case, she had no political affiliation. She had expressed sort of ideas that maybe rubbed the wrong way to some people. And so for her whole life, Maria Martin's father tried to bring his wife to a cemetery, But the town didn't allow this to happen. And so when he died, he asked Maria to continue the work. She did. She wrote hundreds of letters to everyone she could think of, asking them to exhume her mother so she can take them to the cemetery, so she can take the remains to the cemetery with her father. Something that's very powerful about Maria Martin's story is that she passes away during the making of a film. And this was something really impactful for us. It was very difficult. But she ended up representing the fate of so many thousands and thousands of Spaniards who actually die without seeing something so absolutely basic as to be able to bury your loved ones in a dignified way. And what's really powerful about her story, too, is that her daughter, who had always not refused to help, but she did not participate in her mother's efforts. She decides to pick up her mother's struggle and she joins the lawsuit to continue her mother's work. This is also very symbolic and very representative of what happens in Spain, because very often people think, well, the story is being lost because the people are dying. And the truth is that fear is inherited, the trauma can also be inherited, and the need for justice is also inherited. And Maria Martin's daughter represents that inheritance of the need to continue the memory and the justice.
You do have a character who is at the opening of a mass grave in Guadalajara, Asuncion, and she is able to find her father's remains. What was it like to be with her?
Right. Asuncion is another really powerful, beautiful character in the film. She asked the judge, could you please exhume my father so I can die in peace and I can be buried with him? She achieved her dream. She was able to exhume her father.
Was this the first time you had been to one of these mass grave openings?
Yes, actually. I had never been in an exhumation, so for us it was very, very difficult. It's very impacting, I think, because you see it on, I had seen films, you know, but being there and seeing, I think, you know, there is a scene in the film that we call Homage to the Dead, and it was our way to pay tribute to those, I guess for some people they may be bones, but as we saw them in the film, they were people, they were humans that had been executed. And so I think thinking of them as people rather than as, you know, remains was powerful for us to be able to make the audience understand what had happened.
I actually went to one of these mass grave openings about 10 years ago in Spain. The people who came to see what was happening weren't bystanders in a classic way. They were people searching for family members. And explain to us how the opening of those mass graves began.
Right. So there had been some openings of mass graves in the very early years of the transition to democracy, but the climate of fear kind of was still very prevalent, and those kind of stopped. And there are many theories of why they stopped. Some people think that after a coup d'etat, a failed coup d'etat in 1981, a lot of people kind of stopped. What happened is that at the end of the 1990s and in 2000, some organizations started being formed and started doing exhumations, you know. And so the problem is that the government has not taken responsibility for it. There was historic memory law that provided some funding, but the truth is that it has been civil society that has undertaken the work of exhuming and even trying to count how many people are in mass graves. To this point, the Spanish government at no point has even concluded on an official investigation to say there's such number, this number have disappeared. It's all been so civil society organizations. And so that's why for us, it's always very important to say that our film really comes after the work of so many thousands of people and so many organizations and so many volunteers that have been doing all this work to try to bring out the truth, you know, and not just exhume the bodies, but also exhume, so as to speak, the truth for people to remember, you know, really what happened.
Both of these characters are focused on the impact of the war itself, but most of your characters aren't. They come much past the war. And in fact, José Galiante, whose nickname is Chato, he was tortured under the dictatorship for what sounds like student activism in the late 1960s. Tell me a bit about his story and what he's searching for.
Right. So in a way, each of the people that very generously became part of the film ends up representing many thousands of other people's stories and struggles, right? So the story of Chato is the story of a young person who, in the last years of the Franco regime, is tortured severely. He endures many years of jail. And in 2010, he joins the Argentine lawsuit in order to make sure that his torturer, who lives very nearby him, very close to him, actually is tried and under, obviously, a fair trial and is prosecuted for the crime of torture.
Has the film screened in Spain?
Yes. The film premiered in 2018 in Berlin. And about 8 months later, we went to theaters in Spain. We weren't sure what we were going to expect. So when we premiered in Spain, that first weekend, the film was had the third best average per screen, which means that out of the 19 screens where we were, 19 theaters, which is very little, but quite good in Spain for a human rights documentary film. And so what we started seeing there is that people really needed to hear the story, that people really embraced it and supported it and would send WhatsApps. And when we went to national public television on April 4th, we were like trending topic with 50,000 tweets about the film. The president of Spain tweeted before the film screened. And of course, we had already won the Goya, which is sort of the Spanish Academy Award. And we were again on primetime television with the victims and survivors next to us receiving the award. And so it's something that we had not expected, that the million people who view the film on television, we had not expected. But again, I think it speaks to this idea that I was saying, that the time has come for Spain to deal with it.
The film seems to take a firm stand that the Pact of Forgetting was damaging, but many argued it allowed Spain to move forward into democracy. Do you feel that it did some good?
A lot of people think, not just with the Spanish case, but with other atrocities, that what's best is to leave it in the past and leave it behind and forget, you know, this idea of forgetting. But I think there is a fundamental problem, right, which is that there's this sort of like false dichotomy of, well, you need to exchange peace for justice, right? Leave it behind so we can achieve peace. And there is a question, can you achieve peace without giving up justice? You know, what happens to the hundreds of thousands of people who got no justice, who got no peace? Maybe a big part of society has peace, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people in Spain who has no peace, you know? And so obviously this is an argument for transitional justice experts, but what we see in Spain definitely is that there's a huge part of a population that needs desperately to feel at peace and that needs to deal with it. And so this idea of opening wounds, they always answer very quickly. But for us, the wounds are open. We really want to close them.
Do you think that this moment of global populism on the rise, does it make this issue even more urgent?
Right. You know, something that was really interesting when we premiered in Berlin, some people asked us, well, the good thing is that you don't have extreme right in Spain. This was February 2018, just a few months before, at the end of that year, Spain's right-wing party, extreme right, actually won for the first time since Franco's death, some seats in a regional parliament.
You mean the Vox party?
Exactly, Vox party. We never understood when we were making the film that the film would be so current. We always thought we were making a film to let people know of what happens when you don't deal with the past, you know, and to teach farther generations. But we didn't understand that future that we were thinking of was going to be present, you know, that we were going to be dealing with totalitarian regimes everywhere or with democracies that had totalitarian aspects to them, and that kind of started making us question sort of how did fascism start in the first place in the 1930s. It's something that we did not expect. And in a way, it's humbling that in a way the film becomes a mirror for all of that. Like wherever we go with the film in the world, people start discussing the issues that the film brings up. And they don't only talk about Spain. They talk about their own situation. And we've had tons of debates in the U.S. about Confederate monuments, kidnapping of children at the border, or in Canada about, you know, the internment of Native populations to erase their memory. And so it's something very interesting that we didn't expect would happen, but how beautiful that the film can actually encourage these type of conversations around the world.
The film takes place over a significant amount of time. And during that time, another debate is ongoing in Spain, which is about the remains of Franco himself. He is interred at the Valley of the Fallen, and you filmed there. I visited there this summer, and it's a very dramatic space. What was it like to film there?
This is sort of like a gigantic fascist-like mausoleum. Last thing I heard, I think the cross that is on top of that monument that you can see from kilometers away, like, is taller than the Eiffel Tower. So you get a sense. It's really humongous, right? You know, as a Spaniard, you sometimes when you're outside Spain, you feel sort of the shame. You know, how is it possible that my country has a mausoleum to a mass murderer, you know, to someone who has committed genocide, and that the country is unwilling or unable to deal with it? So in the recent years, actually in the recent months, there's been attempts to remove him. These are met with a lot of opposition, but we need to remember that it's not half of Spain that opposes either. You know, like there's a strong part of Spain who feels so strongly that he should be left there and who doesn't see an offense in having a dictator being buried along with thousands of his opponents who were exhumed from mass graves without their families' consent or knowledge and brought to this mausoleum so that he could create a sign of reconciliation.
How has this changed how you'll raise your own daughter?
Well, she knows a lot already, even though she's only 9. You know, she takes things a little simplistically, right? The bad or the good and the bad. But I think that she has a very strong sense of justice. And I think that's very beautiful, sort of economic justice. And also, she knows a little bit about the history. I think it's very important for everyone to transmit history to their children. Not just your country's history, but your family history. We're getting very beautiful messages from people who have seen the film and have decided to investigate about that one uncle who is cut out of the family picture, that one grandmother who no one talks about, you know, to investigate those little family histories. And I want her to learn not just about her country's history, but about her family history and sort of be able to transmit that history with her to her own children.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Almudena Caicedo, who along with Robert Bejar is the director of the film The Silence of Others, which debuts on PBS Monday, September 30th. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Benjamin Soloway and Anise Modi. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, please subscribe. We'll be back next week. And a note before we go. Episode 1 of our new podcast with the Brookings Institution, and now The Hard Part, is out this week. You'll see it in your First Person feed. If you like it and want to hear more episodes, find And Now The Hard Part on your podcast app and subscribe.